This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The United Nations says that Israel has demolished around 9,000 Palestinian structures in the occupied territories since 2009. Several explosions are reported at a U.S. military base located in an oil field in eastern Syria. The Swedish Prime Minister says her country could be facing a war winter as European nations are grappling with an energy crisis. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A top story this hour, the United Nations says that Israel has razed around 9,000 Palestinian structures in the occupied territories since 2009. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the figure includes hundreds of houses that the residents were forced to self-destroy. The latest such incident took place in Al-Quds, where three families were forced to destroy the buildings they lived in on Saturday. According to the UN body, the policy has displaced 13,000 people and negatively affected the lives of 152,000 others. The buildings are destroyed with the excuse that they lack construction permits, even though many were built decades ago. Israel also tears down the houses of Palestinians suspected of carrying out strikes, a practice that human rights groups say is an unfair act of collective punishment. Well, I talked to international lawyer Bader Grossman an hour ago, and he told us whether, from a legal perspective, Israel has the authority to demolish houses in the occupied West Bank.
This ongoing catastrophe is a legacy of the Oslo Accords, because on any view, nobody maintains that West Bank Palestinian territory is a part of the occupation territories that are recognized by many people in the Atlantic world as being Israel. This is not Israeli territory. This is Palestinian territory. And the idea that the process for erecting and maintaining buildings and doing other civil works, should somehow rest with the occupation military and the occupation legal system because it impacts on their security is absurd. If we were to include in the equation all of those homes destroyed by the occupation military in places like Gaza, the number would be much, much, much higher, would be several times higher, possibly even an order of magnitude higher. It's completely absurd. It's clearly illegal. It's illegal under international law. It's being collective punishment. It's generally illegal in almost every jurisdiction on the planet. It's unacceptable, and it's just as unacceptable that the world stands by and says and does nothing while they continue to do this.
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement is calling out Israel over the death of a Palestinian inmate due to medical negligence. The resistance movement says that Israel is pursuing the policy of gradual killing of the detainees. Islamic Jihad says that the regime has intensified its aggression against inmates and is systematically violating their legitimate rights. Hamas also has reacted to the death of the prisoner, calling it a crime. 40-year-old Musa Harun Abu Mohammed died at an Israeli hospital on Saturday. According to Palestinian prisoners' club, he was subjected to the deliberate crime of medical negligence. Several explosions have been heard at a military facility housing U.S. forces in Syria's eastern province of Deir al-Zor. According to Syrian media, the explosion took place at the American base in the Al-Omar oil field. A plume of smoke is rising out of the area. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in Syria's oil-rich regions. Washington says the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the regions from falling into Daesh's hands. Syria has time and again condemned the U.S. military presence on its soil. It says that the deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources, especially oil. Mohammed Ali explains the motive behind the attacks against U.S. bases in Syria.
According to Sana, Syrian state media news agency, it was quoting some local sources over there in that area who heard the blasts and saw plumes of smoke rising from that U.S. base. This was also followed by helicopters flying over that area. Now, this is definitely not the first time that this happens. Such attacks on U.S. bases in Syria, in that part of Syria, increased recently in the past month. Just on the 28th of last month, there was also a similar attack on a U.S. base, also in Deir ez-Zor's countryside. Now, the base that was attacked last night was located in Al Umar oil field. Of course, the U.S. Forces of occupation occupy the main oil fields in that part of Syria, in eastern Syria, and loot Syrian oil over there. And that base is actually inside Al Umar oil field. Now, what is important to say is that there has been no claim of responsibility for such attacks. But if you ask analysts, this is kind of a form of popular resistance, perhaps, against the U.S., because eventually the U.S. is occupying Syria, it's harming Syrians, it's looting its resources, and it's trying to divide the country by supporting separatist groups like the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces.
Tensions resurfacing between Ankara and Athens, this time over the islands of the Aegean Sea. The Turkish president has accused Greece of occupying the demilitarized region.
You're occupying the islands does not mind us. When the time, the hour comes, we will do what is necessary. Like we always say, we may come suddenly one night.
The Turkish president also warned Greece it would pay a heavy price if it continued to, quote, harass Turkish planes over the Aegean. The two NATO neighbors have been at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the status of those islands, maritime borders and energy resources in the Mediterranean. Ankara says that the Aegean islands were given to Greece under treaties signed after the two world wars in condition that it does not arm them. Ankara accuses Athens of stationing troops on the islands. In June, the Turkish foreign minister also warned that Turkey would challenge the Greek sovereignty over those islands if it continued to deploy troops there. Bolivia's former president, Evo Morales, in an exclusive interview with Press TV, explains how the U.S. lost its superpower status and its grip over South America.
The U.S. is not a superpower anymore. It's not controlling South America anymore. Why are they not an economic superpower? Well, right now, they have inflation and economic problems. They have provoked this conflict between Russia and Ukraine with NATO. Now, they are having economic problems. It's a bit ridiculous to see that the U.S. president is negotiating with Maduro to buy oil. This is something that should be evaluated, or we should ask ourselves what's going on. If I'm not mistaken, 40%.
Well, Morales says that South America used to be the U.S. backyard, but it's now a neighborhood. He also pointed to the U.S. exclusion of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua from the Summit of Americas earlier this year. He recalled how several countries boycotted the event in solidarity with those three countries, and many of the participants spoke out against their absence. Morales said that some residents even questioned the U.S. democracy on its own soil and criticized its foreign military invasions. Morales also pointed to the U.S.-led coups in other countries and their objectives.
According to the Republican Senator Cruz, the left wing in South America has created unsafety for the U.S. That's why the U.S. is trying to provoke these coup d'etats for the countries that are economically, socially, and politically free.
without Venezuela, without Nicaragua.
They just want to impose their ideas. That's why they create these coup d'etats or install military bases. That's why I say it's a democratic rebellion in Latin America.
Morales highlighted capitalism and neoliberalism as the worst enemies of South Americans. The former president said that Bolivia closed down the U.S. military base, guaranteeing its sovereignty, independence, and dignity. He also talked about Bolivia seeking to establish strategic alliances with regional states such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, and other countries including China, Russia, and Iran. Time now for the news review. The energy crisis in Europe is snowballing as nations across the continent are grappling with rising costs and supply shortages ahead of the cold season. Sweden's plan to offer liquidity guarantees worth billions of dollars to Nordic and Baltic energy companies to prevent a financial crisis sparked by the energy crunch. The Swedish Prime Minister says that her country could be facing what she calls a war winter. Germany is also bracing for an energy shortage. The network regulator has given assurances that for now there is sufficient gas supply, but the situation is tense and it could worsen. Russia has shut down gas flows to Germany since a few days ago, citing repairs and technical issues. Meantime, in the Czech Republic, capital Prague, tens of thousands of people have staged a protest, urging their government to control soaring energy prices. Okay, energy prices in Europe and issues there. So let me invite a couple of guests, Lambert Opec, former UK Member of Parliament, to join me from London. Max Chivoli, our correspondent, is Rome. In Rome is also with us. Lambert, allow me to first go to Italy and ask Max Chivoli about the situation in Europe and especially in Italy, where he lives, and then I'll get back to you.
Well, the situation here in Italy is very worrying. A few days ago, the National Association of Entrepreneurs, Confcommercio, has sounded the alarm about the fact that 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of this energy crunch. And the situation in Italy is quite desperate because Italy relies on gas for 40% of its electricity production. Italy's industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity, and the risk is that the products of our steel makers, of our car makers, of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market because companies won't be able to afford energy bills anymore. But also, the Italians are very worried. The bills are going up by 300-400%, and the situation seems very bleak in prospect.
Okay. Now, Lambert, in terms of what Europe has been doing to counter this and to actually try to see that they will not have what this Swedish official is calling war winter, I want to know your opinion about what they are doing. I mean, is this the right thing to do, liquidity guarantees? Is that the solution to the problem?
I doubt whether it will fix it. And the reason is, and there's no easy way to explain this, but we have made catastrophic, and I mean catastrophic, energy policy decisions for about 15 to 20 years. It began when I was a member of parliament, maybe around 2000, 2005, where the green agenda was allowed to run rampant, even though places like the United Kingdom have enough gas and oil reserves and actual coal reserves to make it perfectly competitive and with no prospect of an energy crisis. But instead, because of a dogmatic obsession with the environmental agenda, the country, the United Kingdom, and actually a lot of Europe, has simply exported its emissions footprint. Where to? Well, to Russia, because a lot of Europe was depending on Russian gas, and further afield. And that's really pretty much exactly what's happened. Looking at the direct question you asked, it might help to put those billions in, but it doesn't solve the underlying systemic problem I've just described. You can't build nuclear power stations in 5 years. And if you don't use something else for the base load, and you can't do it with solar, you can't do it with wind because they're not reliable enough. You were talking about Greece and Turkey at the top of the program. Well, the tensions there are partly because there are good reserves of gas and oil in the Eastern Mediterranean. So these things have huge implications. What should we do? We should actually have a more rational approach towards how we power the world. We could have a debate about the green agenda if you like. I'm on record as saying I don't think human beings are destroying the planet. But even if we were, simply getting other countries to give us their gas makes us vulnerable in terms of our energy resources. And that's what you're seeing now. There's no point in being in a conflict situation with Russia at the same time as depending on their gas, because what would you do if you were in Russia's position?
Okay, interesting discussion. Thank you for that, Lambert Opec. Former UK Member of Parliament in London, and Max Chivoli, our correspondent in Rome, Italy. Moving on, former U.S. President Donald Trump has made a blistering attack on his successor, Joe Biden, in an address to his supporters in Pennsylvania.
He's an enemy of the state. You want to know the truth? The enemy of the state is him and the group that control him, which is circling around him. Do this, do that, Joe. You're going to do this, Joe, right?
Now, Trump was speaking 2 days after Biden delivered his speech, accusing him and his Republican supporters of destroying American democracy. Trump said that Biden has given the most vicious, hateful, and divisive speech ever delivered by an American president. He also condemned last month's FBI raid of his Florida home as shameful and a travesty of justice. FBI agents found some 10,000 stolen, non-classified government documents spread across 27 boxes when they searched Trump's home and office. Colin Campbell explains why the FBI has been investigating Donald Trump.
Well, just the fact that he has been so defiant against what the FBI has found and what the Justice Department is trying to carry out, and his desire to try to still motivate his followers, his voters out there who would support him if he was on the ballot in November, to try to convince them that he was on the right side of the law despite all of the evidence that has been coming out against him. Now, of course, he has not gone through due process, so it's still premature to label him as doing anything criminal. But the allegations are there. There is evidence that he did not follow the proper procedure, and that's why he's under investigation. But yet, we see a former president who still wants to convince those who follow him and his most avid fan base that he is still innocent and that he's a target of Democratic lawmakers who just want to prevent him from running for president again. And that's very strategic in the way he's done that. If you follow Trump, he really does speak in a matter of us versus them. Mm-hmm. And he wants as many people on his team as possible. United we stand, divided we fall, right? So he feels that he's able to motivate voters out there, his constituents.
That's it for this newscast.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless. So.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters, police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
State of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support. But I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers.
After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensify, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. Welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story. Let's listen to it. There was a man in Najaf, the city of Najaf in Iraq, who lived near Imam Ali's shrine. He would go to the shrine with his son in the morning to pray, but it was sometimes difficult for his son to wake up. One day, they went to shrine before morning prayers. They noticed the poor man sitting at the shrine's entrance, hoping that the shrine pilgrims would assist and help him. "My child," the father exclaimed to his son, "why is this man sitting here?" "To beg and receive help from people," the son replied. "How much do you think this man will earn doing this?" the father asked. "Perhaps he'll earn a few dirhams," the boy speculated. "Is he certain he will receive this amount?" his father inquired. "No, maybe he'll return empty-handed," the boy said. "My son, look, this poor man has come here at this hour of the night to obtain some potential worldly benefits, and he's hoping that the passerby will assist and help him. While we are certain of the rewards that Almighty Allah has bestowed for rising early and worshipping, and we have unquestionably believe what Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, said, how can we slack off in performing these acts of worship?" This nice story was from Sheikh Jafar Kashiful Qita. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we'll listen to the scholar's note on this story.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are concerned with the importance and significance of performing Salat in its prime time. Based on an account, indicated by the martyr Hujjat al-Islam Hashemi Nejat, there was an old man who was really very successful in his life. And then the late martyr Hashemi Nejat asked that old man about the reasons of his being successful in his life. That person indicated that when he was a young man, he met with the late Haj Sheikh Hasan Ali Nukhodaki, who was a leading mystic in Mashhad, and met that person, and the late Sheikh Hasan Ali Nukhodaki recommended him that in order to reach his desires, he wanted to, the desires of this inquirer, that old man in his young age was his needs. First of all, to go on pilgrimage to Mecca when he's still young, and then he said, in order to be able to enjoy going to Mecca on pilgrimage in young age, and because, young age people are energetic and that they can take, as much pleasure as possible from performing rituals. And the late Sheikh Hasan Ali Nukhodaki told him to perform Salat in its prime time. Another one is that that old man, when he was much younger, said to inquire of Sheikh Hasan Ali Nukhodaki that he wanted to have a good wife and a good family. And then Sheikh Hasan Ali Nukhodaki told him that perform your Salat in its prime time in congregation with other people, with other believers. And the third one, his way, and the third one was that that old man wanted to have a good job and a good life, an easy life. And then again, Sheikh Hassan Ali Nukhodaki told him to perform his salat in its prime time together with other believers in congregation. And after some time, that old man reached all his needs that he had mentioned to the late Hajj Sheikh Hassan Ali Nukhodaki in Mashhad.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Another effect of performing salat in its prime time is that when, according to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when believers perform the prime time, when believers perform the mandatory salat in their prime times, they would receive comfort in the time of hardship, and they would receive comfort in the time of meeting death, and they would be delivered from hellfire in the world hereafter. Based on an account related from the fifth infallible Imam, Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, anybody who performs his or her mandatory prayer, mandatory salat, in the prime time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would certainly guarantee for him being delivered from the hellfire. Another effect is that, according to Qutb al-Ravandi, whose tomb is in the shrine of Hazrat Masumi in Qum, according to Qutb al-Ravandi, there's a piece of hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who said that when a calamity or any hardship is going to be sent to people because of their dissidence, there are three groups of people who would be rescued from any such danger. The first one is, the first group is the people who teach and learn the Holy Quran. I mean, who learn the Holy Quran and teach it to other people, to other Muslims. Another group is, the people, consists of believing Muslims who perform the mandatory prayers in the right time, in the prime time. And the last one, and the last group of people, consists of those people who give priority to developing and improving mosques, because mosques have got a special place and significance in the Islamic religion and Islamic civilization. Another indication in this regard comes from the sixth infallible Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, who mentioned that it's highly recommended to offer prayers to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala after mandatory prayers, especially when performed in the prime time, because those moments are the moments when prayers are going to be fulfilled very easily. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.